This is an ABC podcast.
So we've come out of 30 years of multilateral negotiations that still have us on a course of 3-degree warming by the end of the century. And that's just not good enough. It's not good enough for our countries. It's not good enough for the next generation of any country in the world. And when you put the legal arguments together to see what is the legal responsibility of states, it really starts to change the way they take the issue on board.
I felt powerful when I spoke the language of my people of Solomon Islands. And I felt like I was standing with my ancestors. You know, I felt the powers of the people that had paved the way before me to make it possible for me to stand in front of the ICJ. And the message to the court was the future generations are the one that have the most to lose, and they have the power to course correct.
In December last year, Vanuatu went to the International Court of Justice, also known as the World's Court or the ICJ. Vanuatu and a coalition of other countries argued that nations around the world have a legal responsibility to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to reduce the impacts of climate change. With over 100 countries submitting their testimonies, it was the biggest case in the court's history and the first time the court has heard a case about climate change. Today we're going to meet some of the women who argued their case in court at The Hague. Sisters, let's talk about Pacific Island women who are fighting against climate change. Getting to the world's highest court is no easy feat. There are many steps to even being heard in this global institution. The biggest hurdle is getting enough support from countries at the United Nations. That's what's needed in order to ask the International Court of Justice for their legal opinion. In 2011, Palau attempted this, but they didn't secure enough votes at the United Nations. But in recent years, things have shifted. Vanuatu took the lead and got the support of over 130 nations to get this case across the line. But even before Vanuatu was campaigning at the United Nations, this case goes back a lot further. Today, we're going to speak with two women who have played a big role in bringing this case to the ICJ. It's been 5 years in the making, and it all started in a classroom of law students at the University of South Pacific in Port Vila, Vanuatu. One of these students in the classroom that day was Cynthia Honui. She's from the Solomon Islands and is now the president and founding member of the Pacific Islands Students Fighting Climate Change. Cynthia, the International Court of Justice is an ambitious project for law students, and I know that you've been on a long journey to get there. But can we go back a bit first? What inspired you to study law in the first place?
So I was born from two nurses, and they travel through the remote places in the Solomons a lot. And living in remote places is me going to school by crossing the sea during low tide, and then dropping your bags off and then grabbing your fishing line, going to the shore or stand on a nearby place where you can actually not drown, because I was very young, and then fish for your own lunch during that day. So it's those sort of experience that really made me aware of, you know, the value of the environment. But not only that, but also being exposed to this experiences really make you see every day the changes that happens to it. You know, the ones that feel it the most are the ones that rely on it. And so that's sort of what made me aware of the impacts of it. But one particular experience that I often fall back to in terms of really saying, oh, this is where it started for me, sort of like that push. It was when I was traveling back home to South Malaita, which is in Solomon's, one of the provinces. And for our port, we don't have wharfs there. You get the boats there to come to the ship that you're in to take you to the shore. Mm-hmm. And so the first island that usually greets us when we go to the port, that our port is called Fanale. That's where some of our family members and relatives live on. So it's that image that always greets you and you know, oh, you're home because you see this beautiful island. But when we traveled back, I remember 2010 or 9, we're traveling back. I noticed the difference in terms of the sea level. So I questioned my family, especially my dad and his people, what's happening? And because you can see the houses were literally, some of the posts were in the salt water. But that wasn't how it used to be. So it's like, wait, hang on. Something is different here. So you notice these things. And so I asked the questions. So that was sort of like the start of asking questions about what was it like before? Because, you know, I was young and haven't lived longer than the other relatives. So using their experiences and really looking for answers of why it is happening, more of out of curiosity as well. But the further I went into it, the more I realized that it became more about climate justice and not just about, okay, this is for answers. It is not fair that we contribute almost nothing to it, but it is our people that will, not just the people now, but our people that are yet to come, our children will be the ones that, you know, have the most to lose. So it became about climate justice for me and law. I was actually a science student trying, my family wanted me to go into medicine. But having that experience sort of pushed me to make that brave decision to not really go into a dream that my family had for me, but to make something that I had for myself. And that is to study law, because I believe we're all equal under law and we need certain accountability and a way forward. And when I came to study law, my classmate said that same personal motivation as well, coming from Pacific Island frontline communities, because we realized that this is not just the climate crisis, but a human rights crisis. When your right to freedom of movement is being undermined, when you have salt water, sea level rise, pushing your people to look for water sources further to move from their ancestral homes. So for me, it was personal motivation, but also the further I dove into learning more and more, I saw that a lot of countries, not just in the Pacific, but around the world, are facing a similar issue. And so we need global effort.
So you managed to take a university project to the world's highest court. Why did you decide the International Court of Justice was the best place to fight against climate change?
So firstly, a lot of our advocacy and campaign and some of the perspectives that we had as a group was really shaped by our cultural values. We always say the world is an island. So like all of us, we have a lot to lose, not just those at the front line, but the whole world. And so it needs a global and forward-looking approach. For example, in the Solomons, usually when there's issues on customs or law of the land or that village or that community, it is often the chiefs that we go to seek advice in terms of, okay, this is the way forward. And the chiefs are really influential in the village, or the custom people really influential in the village to bring harmony and peace and to propose a way forward for the people. And so we looked at the ICJ as that same concept, equivalent of the chiefs of our communities. And as a whole world, the more we learn about the existing climate regimes, we saw that there's a deadlock, or we're moving at a pace that is not reflective of the urgency of the matter for our people at the front line. And so we need to accelerate this. And the institution that's relevant to do that is the ICJ, because that's the world chief as we'd like to look at it. And so it has that potential to bring about harmony and peace in terms of the way we're moving at the moment, where some are not on the same page. Some are yet to believe climate change is real. Some call it abstract, you know. And so for people that are front line, this is more than that. We do not want to risk the same thing that's happening to our islands on any other country in the world. So it's about what we can save. And so we want to use law as a preventive measure. And so we were not only looking at researching about different legal pathways that we can take. We were also inspired by the Palau initiative and how we could take it from a human rights perspective, because we know that it is more than climate crisis, but a human rights crisis. And so those were sort of the discussions and motivation in the classroom. And our teacher, really, our lecturer, Dr. Justin Rose, really pushed us to be ambitious. And we looked at all our lists. We looked at ecocide. We looked at different legal pathways. And the one that's the most ambitious one was to take it all the way to the world's highest court, because the jurisdiction that it has. So in that classroom, we were deciding who would like to take this forward. And 27 law students put up their hand and said, we'll action this. And so I was one of the 27 law students in that classroom. Very ambitious at the start, not going to lie. I was hesitant. I thought, you know, this is very ambitious. Who's going to achieve this, you know? But it's having that team that believes and carry the weight with you. And also a big part of how far we've come, the credit goes to the government of Vanuatu. They listen to young people and really heard their calls and supported us since that day one till the ICJ, where we got to present with them, alongside them, to the International Court of Justice.
And Cynthia, as you've mentioned, this case argues that climate change is a human rights issue and not just an environmental one. Why did you want to emphasize this point? Does that change how the world sees it?
Yeah, for a lot of us at the start, we were worried about, you know, the rights of future generations, you know, the principle of intergenerational equity, which traditionally how our people have conducted themselves, have lived off the land, they've made it in a way that the people now have ensured that they're using it in a way that the next generation lives it at a stable way, that the next generation can live in a world that they can pass it on as well. And so it's that understanding and that knowledge from being inspired by our people and the way that they've lived, generations looking after our lands have shaped and influenced, you know, we need solutions that incorporate the rights, not of just the present generation, what about the future generations? Because they are the ones that have the most to lose. And we don't want to think about our own children, you know, having to move from ancestral homes. So we wanted their rights to be protected. So personally, for Pacific Islanders fighting climate change, we wanted the intergenerational equity principle, fairness to future generations, to be included in there. And the human rights mechanisms have evolved, have developed through different ways as well. You see the right to environment being recognized as well. And so the timing was also right. A lot of people, when we started campaigning, you know, it's new to them hearing that this is not climate crisis only, but human rights. They were skeptical. But, you know, the more you tell stories with them, explain how this relates to human rights, the more people, you know, because they live at the front line, they see it firsthand when your right to clean water is affected by the adverse effects of climate change. So we need the world to see it from our lived realities.
And what were some of the biggest challenges in getting this case to the ICJ?
Oh, there's a lot of challenges. One, we were not activist per se. We didn't know how you advocate. We were law students. So capacity-wise, we struggle with that. But there's a lot of research that went into it. There's a lot of protecting ourselves as well. And I think being true to what the Pacific Island is about, the culture, and doing a good representation. But also, it's not individual motivations that we'd like to go to the ICJ just to go to the ICJ. We wanted to, you know, 20 years from now or 10 years from now, want it to be impactful for our people. And so that is a challenge, protecting and staying true to that. Another one is funds. Some of the times when we've traveled, I remember traveling, and because I'm doing it on a voluntary basis, you know, some of us, we've held into our own pockets. Our families are the biggest supporters of the campaign, of the work that we do. We also have the challenge of feeling like you're small against some of the people you step into the rooms with. And using a different language to explain what these concepts mean to your people, it's a challenge as well. You speak a different language to explain it, and you don't feel that it relates to you because that's not your language. There's a lot of challenge. But like we always say, we're doing it for our people, and that is something that keeps us going.
Mm-hmm. Cynthia, the International Court of Justice is a long way from the Pacific Islands. Do you think the judges understood how the lives and culture of Pacific Islanders are already being impacted by climate change?
That's a good question. I was there at the ICJ. We spent almost 3 weeks in The Hague, and it was very inspiring to see how Pacific Islands came together and, you know, did their best to portray in different ways, you know, from the cultural attire to the colors they brought to the court to the content of the submissions. I truly believe the Pacific have done their best to lay before the court the lived realities of the Pacific Islands.
And how did it feel to be presenting at this kind of institution? What was your message to them?
Personally, when I stood in front, it was very intimidating when I started. But the more I went into the content of my submission, it felt powerful when I spoke the language of, you know, the people of my of Solomon Islands. It's cheesy as it sounds. I felt like I was standing with my ancestors. You know, I felt the powers of the people that have paved the way before me to make it possible for me to stand in front of the ICJ. And the message to the court was, you know, the future generations are the one that have the most to lose, and they have the power to course correct. And so that's what they should do.
Cynthia, climate change is such a big issue. How do you encourage individuals to help tackle it and not be too overwhelmed?
From my own experience, it's not an easy journey, because the first thing you have to do is believe that what you're doing can bring impactful solutions for your people. And that's often not easy to believe when you often feel like you're hopeless, like the power is not in your favor. But what I would say is, as long as you know you've done something in the right direction, if you're advocating and encouraging young people to pick up the rubbish or to learn more about environmental impacts, those things matter, because the whole world together, if they do their own part, little steps make a whole picture. So I wouldn't say you need to go to the ICJ to be impactful. You can start in your own way, in whatever capacity you have, as a teacher or as a young person in your own community. As long as you contribute, I believe every contribution matters. And don't be overwhelmed by how big it is. I appeal to young people in the Pacific and around the world, but mostly in the Pacific, if they'd like to reach out and be part of this organization, we'd be very happy to have new members and young members. So just type in Pacific Island Students Fighting Climate Change on Google. It can find us as well on Facebook and Instagram.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Ale, thank you, Tomas.
That's Cynthia Honui, the president and founding member of Pacific Islands Students Fighting Climate Change.
You're listening to Sisters Let's Talk on ABC Radio Australia.
For the past 25 years, Coral Pasisi has been working at both the community and international level for sustainable development and climate change financing. She's currently the Director of Climate Change and Sustainability, or CCES, at the Pacific Community. Coral also travelled from her island home of Niue to The Hague to present to the International Court of Justice. Coral, you've presented at the United Nations and other global institutions over the years. How did it feel to present at the International Court of Justice? Did this case feel any different for you?
Yeah, thanks. That's a really good question. It did feel really different. I hadn't ever envisaged that the judges would be so close and the courtroom would be so intimate. I thought it would be quite big, like most of the UN conferences that I've, you know, participated in. The UN Security Council is fairly intimidating. But I have to say, it was a very different feel than, you know, sort of the last 25 years of multilateral engagements that I've had, for lots of reasons. But primarily because we were talking to the highest multilateral court in the world, and it really did feel like We had the upper hand so far as being very clear about this being a justice issue, a climate justice issue, rather than, you know, the normal multilateral negotiations where everyone's trying to protect their own interests. And, you know, we definitely go in with the moral high ground as Pacific people, as, you know, producing the least amount of carbon dioxide emissions. But being on the front line, people tend to listen to our voices with a little bit more empathy.
And what did you argue there?
Well, first off, it was such a privilege being part of what was a very strong contingent of Pacific Island countries. And what's really important in context is this is the biggest court case the International Court of Justice has ever had. They've never had more than 100 submissions from states around the world. So it was a really good indication of just how important it is to so many different countries. And then to have the Pacific there in full force with such strong arguments was really quite incredible. So one of the issues that I presented at The Hague was access to finance, the lack of access to finance, in particular for small island states. It's a very complex system that the multilateral financing mechanisms have, and you really have to have a lot of capacity, a lot of knowledge to access those. So for small countries like Niue, you know, the amount of effort that you have to put in up front to access those funds is enormous. Mm-hmm. And by the time those funds are flowing, it can be like six years later. So you don't actually see any real difference on the ground until 7 or 8 years after a community has asked for help. And that kind of time frame is ridiculous. The portion of presentation that I put forward, I kind of focused on two things. One was what loss and damage looks like in the Pacific, because lots of people don't understand what Indigenous people and culture and cultural practice looks like in the Pacific context, which is quite different from other countries and continents around the world. And so the example that I used was Cyclone Hatta from Niue. And there's sort of two key loss and damage elements that are well reflected by that example. And it's the economic and non-economic losses. So the economic losses, you know, pretty well understood and argued with the five times the cost, that, you know, the price of GDP. But the non-economic losses, I think Niue's got one of the best examples with the loss of 90% of our cultural artifacts when the museum was washed off the cliff. And so those are things that you can never get back. You know, that kind of thing robs our children of their future inherent rights.
As you've mentioned, you lived through the devastating Category 5 Cyclone Hatta, which hit Niue in 2004. Can you take us back there? What happened?
Yeah, so Category 5 Cyclone Hatta hit Niue, but it hit five countries in the Pacific in the course of its journey through Polynesia. I think it hit Niue probably the worst, but, you know, it was at that time we really didn't have strong internet connection. We'd had about four false alarms over the 2 years preceding. So people weren't really prepared for just how big it was going to be. Mm-hmm. And I only knew that it was going to be really big because I actually worked for SPREP at that time based in Samoa, but I was home for Christmas. And it hit Samoa first, and I was supposed to fly out that day. And my colleagues from SPREP in Samoa called me and just said, this is huge. You really need to prepare for it effectively. And we were very lucky, actually, because, you know, my dad had had a heart attack 4 days prior, and he was in hospital. And we didn't want him to worry about my two brothers and their families living on the lower terrace anyway. Mm-hmm. When I say lower terrace, that terrace is 25 meters above sea level. So it's not like on the sea level or anything. It's pretty high. But we evacuated them up to our family home, which is in the, you know, much higher area, just so our dad wouldn't sort of be too stressed. As well we did that because, you know, their homes were completely washed away. That whole western side of the island where all those young families lived was completely destroyed. Yeah, so we lost a huge amount of infrastructure. The damages totaled five times the GDP, which was kind of, that was, for, you know, for context, that was 200 years worth of exports.
Yeah.
For Niue at that time, we lost sort of our only hospital, our only wharf, our only museum, and countless churches, etc. So it was an incredibly scarring event.
And Coral, how did this influence your work and your career?
Well, I was fortunately already at that point. I mean, I think I was born to be a scientist, to be honest. So I was well and truly on track in that climate space and that protection of the environment. And I had already been engaged in the RioPlus10 discussions at that time. And so I was working already in the space of sort of seeing how does international action and inaction impact on our countries in the region. And so that was a very stark realization of what was to come if we, you know, didn't get enough traction in global ambition and access to resources. And that's really underpinned, I think, my passion in the climate change space to get justice for our countries. Because if this is an occurrence that we're going to have, you know, yearly by 2050, there's absolutely no way we can effectively respond to that kind of impact.
And as you live through the impacts of climate change, how have you seen women being impacted, in particular in Niue and elsewhere in the region?
In lots and lots of ways. They're often on the front line of the impacts, and that varies from in urban areas as well as in rural areas. There are a lot of the subsistence level food security areas are really impacted by climate change, both in fast onset events like cyclones and flooding, but also in the slow erosion of many of the areas that they use for traditional practice and knowledge and passing that on to the next generation. So it does impact them in a very different way.
And what impact are you hoping that the case will have?
Well, we're very much hoping that it will shift the gears of global ambition, which are vastly short of what we need them to be to change the course that we're all on. And that's not just Pacific countries, that's every country in the world. And, you know, there's nothing like bringing a legal responsibility to the table to make people change the way in which they are, and countries change the way in which they are setting goals and targets and enforcing them and making them happen. And so we've come out of 30 years of multilateral negotiations that still have us on a course of 3-degree warming by the end of the century. And that's just not good enough. It's not good enough for our countries. It's not good enough for the next generation of any country in the world. And when you put the legal arguments together to see what is the legal responsibility of states, parties to have addressed this, it really starts to change the way they take the issue on board and think about it, because there are liability issues associated with that, which we have not had in the multilateral system to date.
Coral Pasisi, thank you so much for making time.
Thank you so much.
That's Coral Pasisi, Director of Climate Change and Sustainability, or CCES, at the Pacific Community. The International Court of Justice is expected to deliver their legal opinion midway through 2025. You can hear more from Coral Pasisi on our sister series, Climate Mana. Take a listen to it for more stories of resilience. Just type in Climate Mana ABC in your search engine. Thank you to my guests today, Cynthia Honui and Coral Pasisi. If you're interested in getting involved in Pacific Islands students fighting climate change, we will put a link on the Sisters Let's Talk program page. Thank you so much for joining me, Natasha Metten, for Sisters Let's Talk on ABC Radio Australia, a weekly show by Pacific Island women for Pacific Island women, where we get together to talk about the issues that are important to us. If you've missed an episode of the show, catch up on our podcast. Just search for Sisters Let's Talk wherever you get your podcasts or Kias into your favorite search engine. Sisters Let's Talk is presented by me, Natasha Metten. Our producer is Rachel Bongiorno, and Faleangafulu Inga Stunzna is our executive producer. Sisters Let's Talk is produced on Darumbal, Yagara, and Turubo land and the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay respects to elders past and present.